Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King on the rising death toll in Egypt. Restaurant week has begun in Boston. Yum, yum, yum. Plus, should we bring back happy hours around here? Then, Charlie Baker has probably made up his mind about whether he'll run for governor. Will he tell us? Stay tuned. Callie Crossley and David Bernstein update us on their mayoral candidates forum. Breastfeeding is still a no-no at work, and will countries boycott the 2014 Russian Olympics over gay rights? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7. And you are listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is still on vacation. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and South End News is filling in for Jim. Hello, Sue.
Hello, Marjorie.
You're doing a fine job.
Thank you very much.
It's not easy. You know, he has very large shoes.
You know, if you keep saying that, he'll come in tomorrow and say, you know, that's enough of you, O'Connell.
Okay, so just when the presidential race seems simple for 2016, Chris Christie versus Hillary Clinton. Scott Brown and Howard Dean are now sending out signals that they may jump into this race as well. We're going to talk about the road to the White House and other stories with CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. Hello, John King. How are you?
Marjorie, Browdy's pulling a fast one on you. I just saw him at the Iowa State Fair.
Is he eating a hamburger, you know, or a hot dog, or a corn dog?
He's eating bacon-wrapped pork and asking the people of Iowa if they think he should run for president.
Well, you know, John, Jim thinks he should run for president. I mean, you may have deduced this by now.
No, he doesn't want to run for president. He wants to be president.
That's right.
That's a very different idea there.
It is good to be king. It is good to be king. There we go.
So, John, you know, the Egypt situation is just getting more horrific. Death tolls now at 1,000 people, including 36 Morsi supporters who died Sunday under rather suspicious circumstances in police custody. Most Americans, a new poll says, want America to cut off aid to Egypt. Obama, we just heard in the news, may have secretly already done that. But the New York Times says this morning, this is a quote from them about Obama's, quote, muted chastising of the generals and his indecisive reaction to the slaughter there does not inspire confidence. So what's going on here, John King?
This is one of those tests that presidents, this is why the former presidents, whether Democrats or Republicans, when they get together, they all understand each other. This is why it's a lonely job, because he has no good choices here. The military is ignoring him and his defense secretary and his secretary of state when they get on the phone and they say, please back off, please dial it back. They thought, not that long ago, Marjorie, 10 days, 2 weeks ago, they thought they were pretty close to a deal. The Emiratis and the Qataris were brokering with the different factions in there, and they thought they were close to a deal to essentially have a circuit breaker here and give the Muslim Brotherhood something and get them to pull their people off the streets. Then that collapsed. And so the president's looking up now, and cutting off aid is an easy one, right? You see the outrageous pictures, you see the outrageous behavior, but then what do you have?
As a bargaining tool, in a sense.
Right. It's clear we have very limited leverage, but it's the only relationship we have
with
the Egyptian military.
Can you explain to me what, you know, basically what is the amount of aid as it compares to other amounts that we give to other countries? I mean, I'm hearing that it's not that big a number. It's not that big a deal. It's really just an insignificant amount. But on the other hand, you know, they're a major receiver of our money.
Yeah, it's $1.3 billion. I know that much.
It's just shy of $1.3 billion this year in the military aid. Then there's some economic assistance that goes as well that floats the number up closer to $1.5. Look, one of the loudest voices to continue this aid is the government of Israel, our chief ally in the region. And they would argue, yes, what we're seeing right now is ugly, messy, pick your word, it's horrendous, it's heinous, it's even worse than that. But they would also argue over the past 30 years, there haven't been any radical attacks on Israel from the Sinai, right? The peace agreement with Egypt has kept.
Right.
We have a lot of intelligence sharing with the Egyptian military, a lot of counterterrorism activity, a lot of covert stuff that happens with the assistance of Egypt, flyover rights, quick passage through the Suez Canal. So there are benefits. Now, a lot of people out there are saying at some point those benefits are outweighed by the moral outrage, and that's the dilemma the president faces. Here's the money so far. The administration, what the administration has done is they've not stopped it, they've not suspended it. They're in what they call a review, and during that review, I'm going to say they hit the pause button. That's my term, not a State Department term. But they're not going to cut any new checks while they're having this review. And of the it's about $1.23 billion in military assistance this year, $650 million has already gone out the chutes. So there's about $585 $590 million still left to spend. And you're not going to see and it's usually not money. Usually it's we send you F-16s or we send you Apache helicopters. It's a lot of it's equipment. And you know, and the U.S. economy benefits from that. Let's be honest about that. That's part of the, you might say, cynical side of this. But it's about jobs here as well as, you know, leverage in Egypt. But the administration's not going to send any of that $585 million out the door during this review. And the great hope is that in, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, we look up and we see relative calm. And then they can have a conversation about what's next. There's no question this has changed the relationship. The question is really going to be, has it ended the relationship or just significantly hampered the relationship?
We're talking with John King from CNN about the continuing unrest and violence going on over in Egypt. You know, John, you just mentioned about how much leverage the president has. I've been reading these last couple of days that really previous presidents, you know, going back to Bill Clinton and even before, haven't had that much leverage over in Egypt either. When Clinton and Bush were trying to make deals with Mubarak before he was ousted. So, you know, I wonder again if we're just looking at this from our perspective, this leverage thing seems not to be, or lack of, seems not to be that new.
It's always a question of relative leverage or the crisis of the moment. Again, Egypt's role in the region, if you go back over 25, 30 years, it's the beacon of the region. It's the most educated society. It's been traditionally the more moderate, the most pro-Western piece. And traditionally, it's also had the stronger economy, which is gone now because of tourism and the Saudis and the petrochemical, you know, the energy economy has eclipsed Egypt in the last 25, 30 years as that has taken over in the region, the money in the region. But it's always had the moral standing in the region. And you're right. Look, I remember when Bill Clinton wanted to get the peace deal done with Yasser Arafat. He was up at Camp David, and Arafat started to back away. One of the first people Clinton called was Mubarak. He said, help me, push him. And the Egyptians, but also the Jordanians and others, said, well, we weren't part of these negotiations. We don't know what this deal is. And they couldn't push Arafat to the finish line, and the whole thing collapsed. So it's never been perfect. If you go back and study, you know, the real politique, I would say, of like the Jim Baker era, you know, there were some people out there who say, why were we dealing with Mubarak for 30 years? He was a brutal dictator who threw his political opponents in jail and tortured them and beat them and denied them any speech, never mind free speech, denied them any speech. But we did business with him. Part of this goes back to the Cold War because different presidents of both parties decided it was in the U.S. national security interest to have this relationship. It's a different world now.
John,
and we have no idea where this quote-unquote Arab Spring is taking us, not just in Egypt, but all around the region. And this president and probably the next two or three presidents are going to be dealing with this, you know, very frustrating part of the world.
John, does this add, though, you know, Egypt being what it is and Marjorie making the point that this has never been a tremendously successful relationship, but on the heels of our inability to get or Obama's inability to get Snowden from Russia and China and some people's expressed disappointment with the Obama administration on Israel, does this sort of news add another brick to the Obama's not great internationally wall?
Sure. I think it does, you know, add something. Remember, the first place he went as for a foreign policy speech was Cairo. He went to Egypt, remember?
Yes.
And he told the world, I'm not George W. Bush. I'm going to repair America's standing in the world, which he thought had been significantly undermined by Iraq. And most of the focus of that speech was the Arab and Muslim world. And here you have the Arab and Muslim world, whether you're looking at Libya, whether you're looking at Syria, whether you're looking at Lebanon now, whether you're looking at Egypt, I could go on and on and on, a big giant question mark. And this is going to be the challenge of a generation. And let's hope that good things come of it, that in the end, after a mess, you have something like the collapse of, you know, Eastern Europe after the Cold War. Looks pretty good now. Back in 1989, nobody knew what it was going to look like in 10 or 20 years, and it worked out okay. Sure. In a second term, what's frustrating for any president is in a second term, especially when you have a Congress led at least in half by the other party. You look around the world for a few more legacy achievements, and this president's having a really hard time right now. And that's not a criticism of him personally. That's just the fact.
John, one of the challenges that I've been having with understanding what's happening in Egypt is my American perspective that every democracy and every constitution is going to look like ours, you know, that I'm just going to – they're just going to have complete democracy in the style that we have. This coup that happened and the uprising since – was it in fact sort of an allowable coup within the framework of their constitution, or is it just one of those complicated issues that Americans are going to continue to have a hard time wrapping their mind around?
It's very hard. It can't happen here. We have
right.
This is why we have elections. You know, we have elections that sometimes shock us. Massachusetts Democrats were shocked. I'm not trying to make I'm trying to equate these here. But when Scott Brown won that race, the country was stunned, and the Democratic Party was stunned when the Tea Party came out of nowhere. A lot of people are still having a hard time with the fact that we have an African American president. Surprised by that, but we do it through elections. And sometimes they're messy, and sometimes they're ugly, and there's probably way too much money involved, and all that stuff. But in the end, it's an election. This was done. The hard part here is that this was done, and look, the administration says it didn't know it was coming. I know for a fact from the Qataris and the Emiratis, there was some heads up that this might happen, that they saw it coming. The administration was convinced that Morsi, after one more parliamentary election, was trying to impose an Islamic Republic in Egypt, and that was a huge danger both to the United States' interest, to Israel, and to the region. And so they were not unhappy when this happened. They were not unhappy at all when this happened. They just hoped that the more moderate forces within the Egyptian military would then, you know, bring in measured political figures to lead the interim government and then announce some plan toward a democracy and then cut some kind of a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood. None of the pieces 2 and 3 didn't happen. And so now you have chaos and a huge question mark. And again, I'm not saying it's the right decision, but when you talk to people inside this administration, and also a lot of people who served in both Bush administrations and even back to the Reagan administration, so Republicans, not just Democrats, say, what is your choice here? The Egyptian military is the only force, the only institution in the country that can hold it together, and we need it to be held together even if we don't like what it looks like. Because if it collapses, then Al-Qaeda comes in. And the one simple way to put this is the happiest people, if the administration just said forget about it and walked away from Egypt, the happiest other party in the world would be Al-Qaeda.
Okay, well, let's move to something that's a little bit easier to talk
about. Let's go Red Sox.
Before we get to the Red Sox, I mean, you spotted Jim Browdy, my co-host here, out in the Iowa State Fair last week.
Kidding, but he'd love to be there.
Well, somebody else that was actually there was our own former United States Senator, Scott Brown, and talking about actually testing the waters to see whether there's room for a moderate Republican like Brown in the presidential race 2016. Now, Democrats back here kind of making fun of him, as they would. But is this getting any traction, this notion of Scott Brown testing the waters for 2016?
Could have saved the airfare and just called Rudy Giuliani, I think. found out. Look, I say that as a joke. As a student of the process and as someone who's followed the both parties through this process now since the late 1980s, the Republican Party is in a mess right now.
Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of the mess the Democrats were in after Walter Mondale lost 49 states, and everyone thought the Democratic Party is dead, it's going to have to be something new, and this guy named Bill Clinton came along and served as a modifying and a unifying force within the party. And Bill Clinton pulled the left Democratic Party, Bill Clinton pulled it toward the center. There are many Republicans who say Romney and McCain lost because they catered too much to the conservative base in the primaries on immigration, on abortion, on gay rights, on women's issues. So you lose the suburbs, you lose young people, and you lose the national election. And Scott Brown would be in that group, and they want to have this debate. And Chris Christie would be in that group, and they want to have this debate, saying if we want to win nationally, we have to, you know, start paying closer attention to certain constituencies, and we can't just pay attention to red states. But there are other people, and these people I think are winning the debate at the moment, and they include Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, who say those guys lost because they weren't conservative enough. They lost because, you know, they seem to flip. You know, Romney wasn't credible on abortion, or they didn't push the buttons on the social issues hard enough or on the fiscal issues hard enough. Parties out of power go through these debates. So I would say this. I think that if the party would actually have that debate, good for Scott Brown and good for Chris Christie and good for, you know, Jeb Bush would be more to the right than either of those two guys, but not as far right as Ted Cruz. The party's going to have this debate because it will eventually pick a nominee for 2016. Before you pick who can lead the party, you have to decide, and the Republicans have done this now twice on a temporary basis with McCain and Romney, but you have to decide, what are we? What do we believe in? Then you choose your leader.
You know, Marjorie, I think that the Democrats, the big D Democrats here, are mocking Scott Brown. But I think the people in general are not, because I think that the idea of a Scott Brown conversation and his moderate ideas and his, you know, in my estimation, you know, his representation of the sort of basic Republican ideals of the, you know, 1960s and 70s in some ways would really be a good addition to it, especially being from Massachusetts and being a different type of Republican.
Well, think about, I'm dating myself here, but when I came out of college, I was in Rhode Island. I went to the University of Rhode Island, and, you know, John Chafee, the Chafee family.
Oh, yes.
New England Republicans. Lowell Weicker was the senator from Connecticut. Nancy Johnson was a congresswoman from Connecticut. George Pataki ended up being governor of New York. You had Ed Brooke in Massachusetts, followed by Scott Brown. You had Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins. Now you just have Susan Collins in the state of Maine. The Northeast, I won't call it just New England, because New York and New Jersey, Tom Kane, the governor of New Jersey, you had a more moderate and conservative Republicans, say liberal Republican Party, but you had the big tent. It was the big tent. And when it's like Thanksgiving dinner. You have some amazing fights, but it's your family. It's your family in the end. So you invite them back next year, even though you're muttering under your breath, that dirty, rotten SOB, you know, half the day or whatever. The Republicans have lost that. Some Republicans don't want that. They don't want a good party, if you want to be a national political party in a country that is so diverse like this and changing so fast, and where the 50 little pieces are so different, you have to welcome the Thanksgiving dinner debate. If you don't, you become a smaller, isolated party. And the Republicans do run the risk of being, and I'm one of them, demographically, the party of the aging white guy. You can win a lot of House districts in the aging white guy party. You can win some governorships in the aging white guy party, but you can't win the presidency in the aging white guy party. The math doesn't work.
You know, the aging white guy party is a perfect description, because I was down at the summer convention for the GOP that was in Boston last week, where Chris Christie did get a standing ovation, by the way. But you are struck by it, not necessarily be aging, but everybody is white. A lot of people are in red, white, and blue outfits. You know, you go to Democratic get-togethers, and it is a rainbow coalition. You know, you have African-American.
But Marjorie, I remember back in during the Clinton DNC when he was nominated and looking. This is the first time that the gay and lesbian groups, Human Rights Campaign, had a presence at we were out and we were there. And I remember looking on television and thinking, oh my God, this is some people's worst nightmare. It's like, oh, the gay people are voting. Oh no, you know.
But you know what I'm talking about? It looks like the 1950s in a way versus this much different group of people you see at the Democratic conventions. And I kept thinking about that last week when I was there, how difficult it's going to be for the Republicans, if they don't do something dramatic, to move beyond that very white and old-fashioned, narrow base.
And think about the point you were just making, though. It was when gay and lesbian organizations started to have a more prominent public role. First it was the unions. Remember, Bill Clinton ran against the unions. Yep. Then Bill Clinton had his sister soldier moment, a guy who had a lot of credibility in the African-American community back home, but who had a big national fight with Jesse Jackson to prove that I'm not going to be, quote-unquote, beholden to the special interest in the party, as he put it. Just think about during this presidency. Does Barack Obama go from a firm opponent of same-sex marriage in 2008, I'm against it, to somebody who then in his second inaugural address talks about it as a huge civil rights moment for this country? Does he get there? A lot of this was his wife. A lot of this was his children. Some of this was his senior White House staff. But it's also because the Democratic Party is that Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
Sometimes you disagree with them, but you still invite them back next year.
John,
over the course of those couple of years, you change your mind on some issues.
I'm amazed every presidential election season that when the Democrats, for the most part, get in line, here you have this group that are fighting with each other all the time, that the one, the right and the left of the Democratic Party are very far apart. But, when it comes time to get to the polls and get it done, this fighting gaggle of different people get it together, and the Republicans can't. And it's amazing to me.
Well, we're about to find out, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes these are temporary fixes. George W. Bush won twice, remember?
Right, right.
In our not too distant past. And a lot of people in the Democratic Party thought he was a village idiot. And the Republicans put together a better organization, and they had a good candidate. His political skills are just, I'm sorry to borrow a term, misunderestimated. and so when you have the presidency, you mute your differences. And to the credit of the congressional leadership and the governors, there are a lot of, you know, Guantanamo Bay is still open. They don't think he spent enough time on poverty. A lot of African Americans don't think our first African American president has spent enough time, whether it's on guns or other crime or, you know, economic development, on the streets of Chicago and New York City. And they'll tell you that privately, and sometimes they tell him to his face. The Latino community is mad at him because they think he could have done more to keep his promises on immigration. But they tend to do it more privately or more quietly. And when somebody does speak up, the leadership, you know, smacks them down and says, hey, remember, you know, you didn't hear all these fissures in the Republican Party date back to the Bush administration. They were there when he was president. You just didn't hear that much about them until late in his term, when the public completely turned, even Republicans turned on Iraq, after the competence question of Katrina. Remember, the last couple of years of the Bush administration, the civil war in the Republican Party started while he was still president. There's a chance that could happen to this president after the midterm elections. If the Democrats take a pounding next year, trust me, any Democrat who wants to run in 2016, when Barack Obama won't be around, is not going to worry about President Obama anymore. They're going to start worrying about themselves. And that's why, you know, if Hillary Clinton does run, and if there's not really a contest on the Democratic side, that would probably mute the differences. You know, she would be effectively the incumbent running for the nomination. But if she doesn't run, we'll see if Joe Biden runs. He wants to run. If she doesn't run, I suspect he will. There are some who say he will anyway. But if you get a Cuomo, Hickenlooper, O'Malley, I know Deval Patrick says no. You know, but that group, then Howard Dean, you're going to have that fight, and the Democrats are going to go back to being Democrats, and boy, and the Republicans will be in their civil war, and the Democrats will say we've waited 8 years for this fight, and it's going to be messy.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that Howard Dean was considering another run, but apparently the former Vermont governor is going to Iowa next week. But John, I want to ask you about one more thing on the Republican Party. It's one of their crusades. The Heritage Foundation is doing this series of these small town meetings about repealing Obamacare. And here's former South Carolina Jim DeMint shrugging off a question about the effort.
Senator DeMint, what's the point of voting to defund Obamacare when we know that President Obama won't sign it?
Well, we don't know that, do we?
So this is kind of a traveling crusade, I guess, all across the country, you know, trying to talk about repealing Obamacare. So what's happening with this? And am I correct? Is some Democrats giving the alternate opinion after the Republicans leave town?
Look, the Obama people and his old political group, now it's called Organizing for Action, and other labor unions as well, have been very effective at showing up at a lot of these Republican events and asking these questions. So some of this is not, you know, pure grassroots, but I'm not criticizing it. I'm a big fan of organizing. If you can organize and get in the other guy's face, good for you. You know, that's part of politics. And if these guys want to have town halls, I wish they would all have town halls. A lot of them in both parties are being cowards, because they're afraid of these questions and these criticism. You want to run for office, you should go back and talk to your people. It should be a simple – it should be required, but you can't do those things in a free society, I guess. But look, there are – you know, I understand Senator DeMint's point. He's at a think tank now, and we are so opposed to this, we have to do everything we can to block it. But at some point, you have to decide if you're a responsible party in the government. The president's bill passed. We've had elections since then. We've had a Supreme Court challenge that failed. And so if you oppose Obamacare, that's why we have elections. You know, Mitt Romney opposed it. He lost. If he won the presidential election, he would have been able to say, I have a mandate to stop this thing. He lost. And, you know, it was close in some ways, but from the Electoral College perspective, the president's won. And so I understand the principle of the conservatives, and you have to respect their opinion. They oppose this. They think it's big government. They think it's bad policy. That's fine. The question is then, how tactically do you try to achieve your goals? And if you're going to say we're just going to keep standing in front of the train when the train has, you know, has the ratification of the American people in an election, that's why, you know, Speaker Boehner does not endorse this strategy. He thinks it contributes to the Republicans' obstructionist, hurts the Republicans with certain key constituencies. So you have these conservatives saying we're going to primary challenges against Mitch McConnell, a new primary challenge against Senator Lamar Alexander in Tennessee. So this is what happens. Increasingly, our politics are decided in primaries, not general elections anymore. And it's the same for the Democrats. It's more interesting for the Republicans right now because they're the party out of power, and you have these huge debates like this. Are they going to shut down the government over this? I don't think so. I don't think their leadership will let them. But is this more proof that on this issue, on immigration, on gay rights, on whether to even talk to Democrats, that the Republican Party is still very early in its, you know, what some call a soul-searching, what I will call a circular firing squad. They're still early in the process.
So, John, before we let you go, a Boston boy, Restaurant Week is happening here in the Boston area, you know, where you get to a nice low price to try some of your new favorite restaurants. What are some of your old favorite restaurants?
I'm going to get in a lot of trouble.
Of course,
this.
You are. There's no way you're going to win
disaster,
on this. This is your Egypt, John. This is your Egypt.
This is my Egypt, and I'm going to. If, you know, somebody out there is going to endorse military aid or a drone strike on me if one I pick sides. But you know, I come up every now and then for the Common Square Health Center has a fundraiser every year. Right. Been to Boston, and I'm coming up in September for that. And there are some great, fabulous restaurants that, because of their community service. I'll tip to them. But one of my favorites is a place called Taranta, mm-hmm. right at the edge of the north end, north side of Hanover Street. It's a Peruvian Italian mix, and the chef Jose is just fabulous, and the food is out of this world, and the Pisco Sour is to die for. And then here I am as a Dorchester guy. I'm going to send you should go to the Ashmont Grill.
Ashmont Grill. That is a great place.
Absolutely spectacular. Great family business. And good courage for an accomplished restaurateur to say, I'm going to go into a neighborhood. I'm going to get out of the city. Yeah. I'm going to get off where, you know, you have all this foot traffic. Those are two. I could give you 100, but I'll start there, and you could keep asking me this question because the people I didn't mention
they'll be calling you right now.
Are now going to, you know, circle the drones on me.
There you go, John King.
Thank you.
John is CNN's chief national correspondent, and as we just projected ahead there, where do you want to eat? Where do you want to go? How much can you pay? Well, food writer Corby Cummer joins us next for a primer on Restaurant Week. So stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Jad from Radiolab. I've got some exciting news. Robert and I are coming to Boston this fall with a brand new live stage show called Apocalyptical. For tickets and info, head to WGBHnews.org.
I'm Adam Riley.
I'm Ibi Caputo.
I'm Philip Martin.
I'm Liz Alessi.
I live here.
And I report here.
They call it the hub. I don't think I really understood what that meant until I got here, but it is. It's a really important city, and it's a really special city.
WGBH.
Boston Public Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Orchard Cove, welcoming, lively. These are some of the words residents use to describe this independent senior community in Canton. You can learn more and arrange a tour at orchardcovelive.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Listen to this. Three-course dinner, $38.13 at Morton's, at Capitol Grill, at Grill 23. All these great restaurants for Restaurant Week, which really is restaurant 2 weeks,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, I had one last night. I was out last night at Club Cafe in Boston having my – I didn't even have to pay for it.
It's been – oh, really? Yeah. So you got a free meal?
No. Well, I was a date kind of.
Oh, you were
so
a date.
Was,
okay.
No.
Anyway, this all gives an excuse or perhaps an incentive to try out these restaurants you wouldn't ordinarily try because they're too expensive. Joining us to talk about Restaurant Week and how to navigate it is food writer Corby Cummer, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and a restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. Welcome back, Corby.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you want to call in with your great stories or your horror stories about Restaurant Week, feel free, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Or if you have questions about it that you want to ask Corby, or if you've learned something from your Restaurant Week adventures past. So, you know, I was reading about this morning, and a lot of restaurants, they're not that keen on this because they say they lose money. Others are very keen on it. So the great meal, $38 at, you know, Grill 23 is a great deal for three-course dinner. But is there a downside to the restaurant?
Oh, there are huge downsides for the restaurants to participate. And I've just been going over the list, which is 33 pages on restaurantweekboston.com, and picking some of my favorites. But I've also talked in the past couple of weeks to a lot of restaurant owners, and I've talked in the past few years, who just opt out. Mm-hmm. They just decide they're not going to. And what's the main beef they have? It's not just losing money. It's the idea that they're not laying out this loss, this effort, this huge crowding during Restaurant Week for repeat business. What they're after is repeat customers.
Yep.
And this is a complaint that has happened that has been going on for years. When Restaurant Week started by the Zagats in New York years ago with the city of New York, then it spread like wildfire all across the country. And restaurants said, under tipping, people don't tip, and they don't come back. And what they really want is repeat business.
Corby, let me ask a question, though, about the economics of it. You know, first of all, folks, restaurants do opt in to be part of Restaurant Week. And some restaurants who are not officially participating do have their own specials that they offer. One of my favorite restaurants in the whole world, Hammersley's, you know, Gordon doesn't necessarily participate, but he does have specials. And his is an issue of quality and happiness with the staff and offering what Hammersley's does well. But my kind of layman's idea has always been that the restaurants make a lot of money on the fluids they serve, on the wines and on the coffee and on the sodas. And that, you know, even though they have additional costs and labor, that they should still be making a little bit of money and filling a restaurant that may otherwise be empty in the months of August. Is that just...
That's the whole rationale of Restaurant Week, to do it during downtime when people are gone. And I went to a restaurant last night that's in a very popular area, and it was mostly empty. And the floor manager said, well, this is our weekend. And he recommended everybody come on Monday and Tuesdays, which are good nights to come to avoid crowds. But as far as, yes, of course, the high profit margins are on drinks. They always are. But if somebody wants to make money and get around the system, it's just volume because they're going to lose money on food. Now, admittedly, food profit margins, any chef will tell you, are much lower than drink. That's where they all have to make their money, right, or else they can't stay in business. Uh-huh. But in this case, it's a sheer volume question. And another big question is, are people going to tip on the real value of the meal? So as a
shame on them that they don't. That's really
well. They don't
awful.
Necessarily tell you
working.
Yeah,
just
but
as
they
hard.
Don't necessarily tell you on the menu. You know, I was, as I said out last night, and it had the total of the $38. You know, whatever it was for the appetizer to the dessert, but it had no cost on what the actual.
Yeah, but you know, you're getting a great deal.
I was no,
a,
yeah, you
as
should.
A waitress
but,
for a long time, I figured they should throw you an extra $10 or something like that to make up for the cost. But this reminds me in a way like Groupon. You know, you always hear people complain about Groupon, the small businesses say, yeah, everybody comes racing in when I have the cheap, you know, massage or the cheap haircut or the cheap yoga class, whatever it is. And then they never come back.
But and for them, it's a real loss.
Yeah, well, that's
a
whole
loss.
Different. Yeah. But, what you know, what's the restaurant selling? I mean, the repeat business, obviously, from a business side. But, you know, these restaurants, some of the better ones are really selling their romance and selling their, you know, pizzazz, if you will. And folks come in and want to try it. So it's sort of this delicate balancing act.
It's a real balance. And when you mention Gordon Hammersley, who's one of the people I most admire in the whole restaurant community of Boston, he and his staff feel they can't offer the experience. And I was really interested looking at the list to see that for Ken Oringer, for example, I noticed Uni Sashimi Bar. Now, that's a place I can't afford to eat on
my
own.
Is it not on the list? Or
It is on the list.
Okay.
Cleo is not.
Right.
Okay. So maybe they feel that because Uni is at a bar, it's simpler, the service challenges are less, whereas Cleo, part and parcel of the whole experience is the service, and they want to make sure you have that Cleo experience.
Right.
Gordon has obviously decided, as a lot of other people have, they can't offer that experience. Then again, number 9, an Eastern Standard, two of the best service spots in the city, they're on the list.
Yeah,
they are.
You know, one of my happiest moments, my little happy place in my head whenever I'm having a very bad day is being at one of those Taste Of, which is a whole nother conversation.
Uh-huh.
But Gordon Hammersley was behind the table and he was cooking a lovely pan-seared scallop with a bacon. And of course, you say this and some people think, oh, that's no big deal, but it was a Gordon Hammersley.
Of course.
Right? And he had it and he served it to me and put it in my mouth.
Ooh.
And said, this is the best one I've cooked all night. I could have died right then. I was all set. I'm done.
So one of the things that's most notable about that story is Gordon showed up.
Right.
He came and he did it himself. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the hallmarks of Hammersley's Bistro.
Yep.
He's there every night.
Yep. And it's beautiful. And they serve the food in the big places in the South End for people that haven't gone. They also have valet parking, I believe. And that's just very important in the South End of Boston.
Marjorie.
We're talking with Corby Kummer, senior editor at Atlantic Magazine, restaurant critic for Boston Magazine, about Restaurant Week, which goes, it was started already and it goes until the 30th. So you have plenty of time to get out there and take advantage. So do you have any great tips for us, Corby? are the great deals or the restaurants that are on the list that you think you should take advantage of now, because otherwise, you know, you'd have to mortgage your house to go there to eat dinner?
Oh, absolutely. And the whole idea is, let's preface this by saying you're going to get a big value and tip really generously.
And then
because just assume that they are losing money. So some of the places that are ordinarily – then I'd like to talk about some of the places that you can generally afford, but this will be even better and you should discover them.
All right.
But here are some of the big ticket places that stood out to me. Number 9 Park, which we've already mentioned. Oishi. Sushi. Oishi and Uni, they're both on the list. I don't know what sushi they're serving, probably a lot less fish, but it's the technique, it's the experience of going. I definitely want to go there. Let's see, Upstairs on the Square.
Ooh, I've been there.
Who can argue with the service there? The food is great, but the service is extraordinary.
And the decor, all those bright pinks and bright greens. One time
decor,
I went there for brunch, and the Harvard a cappella group came in and sang while we were having brunch. I don't know if they do that every week or not, but it was a great experience.
Oh, the whole thing is wonderful, and you will never forget being there. Rialto.
Rialto.
Wonderful standby that for many people is unapproachable and unaffordable afterward. So those are some of the, you know, it's also someplace that people don't think of and is rather high priced and I think has really high quality food is Lavoie, which is on Upper Newbury Street. It's one of the few places in that area of Back Bay that has really good food. It's French owned by this Provençal restaurant owning family from Cannes, if you please.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's really French. It's one of the few places that's owned by French people. Another one is Sandrine in Harvard Square
that's
always
one.
Reliable, has that wonderful Alsatian onion tart in an oven flame.
I'm so hungry.
And that's on the list.
I know.
Why didn't we have them bring in food? Who's producing this show?
You know, because then we didn't have to listen to us eating.
You know what I read that was fascinating too? That because they are getting very reduced prices, like I said before, $38 and change for a 3-course meal, that what they're doing is they're having cheaper cuts of meat and chicken thighs instead of chicken breasts at some of these restaurants, or maybe a smaller amount of fish in the sushi, so they don't get take a total huge loss.
And
on
boy,
the food.
Why should that bother you?
Yeah,
it doesn't bother me at all.
You still get the technique. You get portions that are probably a lot healthier for you to be eating, and you get their imagination, because so often the best dishes and the best cuts are economy dishes.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you have any questions for Corby, because of course I know nothing about Restaurant Week except what I've read in anticipation of this great couple of weeks, I should take advantage of it.
So what's the next tier, Corby? Do you have another tier of restaurants that
we've got the
nice high-end
and
ones?
It's not a tier of quality. It's just visibility.
Right.
So, and by the way, in the tier of absolute fame and visibility, I noticed that Blue Ginger was there. You know, celebrity chef, everybody wants to go there. It's in Wellesley. People can barely afford to pass through the town limits of Wellesley, so this is a time that they can go. Here are a couple. In Beacon Hill Bistro, very interesting farm-to-table cooking, not high enough on people's radars locally for the attention they pay to sourcing local ingredients. Bronwyn, a really interesting new Germanic-themed restaurant from the couple that started TW Food, which was another farm-to-table place in the back of Cambridge.
I'm speaking now this farm-to-table stuff everywhere.
Great.
Oh, it's – yeah. Well, these are some of the pioneers of it, for example. TW Food and Beacon Hill Bistro were doing it before it was, you know, everybody's catchphrase. A number of the other Barbara Lynch restaurants, Butcher Shop, and B&G Oysters.
Yep.
They're right on the list.
Right,
how can you
Bend.
Resist going? They're such reliable. Henrietta's Table. It's one of my favorite restaurants in all of Boston and Cambridge.
I love that. In the wintertime, I love it. Yep. It's very cozy in the wintertime. I think they have like meatloaf or something on the menu there.
Oh, they have everything. Yeah. And speaking of farm to table, Peter Davis, the chef, and the owner of that place, Dick Friedman, you know, part of it was his farm. Henrietta is named for a pig.
You know, I can't help noticing you weigh about 75 pounds over there, Corby, and you're
dripping wet.
Now,
that's right.
Do you run marathons on the weekend, or do you eat small portions, or how do you maintain your boyish physique?
I eat small portions. I don't eat every night because nobody's expense budget anymore can anything like cover that.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I exercise all the time.
You do? Do you run?
No, I read the newspaper on the Stairmaster.
There you go.
Very good.
Do you have any kind of one of those secret foods? I know there's one food critic I know who he has anchovies with mustard and avocado and lettuce and toast. And that's his sort of one meal a day while he's in restaurant review? Do you have like a secret meal that you eat?
You know, I don't. It depends on what cheeses and breads I find on sale, you know, because I'm always looking for different artisan cheeses and shops or somebody new who's doing cured meats. No, I tend to just devour what I buy. I have like no control of what I bring home from stores.
You know, we have an email from Mary Beth in Newton, who says, Newton Center, who says people get treated terribly during restaurant week, especially tables of women. Have you heard those complaints that people get lousy service and treated like second-class citizens?
I think maybe people are on the lookout for being treated badly during restaurant week. Mm-hmm. And if a restaurant is doing it, somebody should look for a place on the site and complain to the organizing organization, because it's going to give Restaurant Week a bad name.
I do know, you know, there are some restaurant managers I know who have to kind of gear up for it, you know, because there are a lot of questions about that. I mean, it's just a lot more service is needed, and it is the slow time of year, and some restaurants aren't as fully staffed as they might be in August, so they have to have new folks come in sometimes to kind of pinch hit, depending on how busy it is or it isn't. So I agree. I think that if you're looking for bad service, you're going to get it. But
there's another really good point, which is tables of women. They often complain that the waiters in the house assumes they're not going to order as many drinks, which means their margin is lower.
Yep.
And that they won't tip as well. It's not that they're bad tippers naturally. I think the assumption is because they drink less, the restaurant is going to make less money.
When I was richer, I used to – when I was had more money, rich kind of is implying relative, rich now.
Relative.
When I could, you know, live – had one paycheck in the bank. I used to tip more. I also had an expense account because I felt like I had the burden of feminism on my shoulders. And now that I don't drink and I often go out with women, which is not surprising, I do feel that, like, I feel guilty when I get the bill sometimes, you know, that is, I may, you know, have a dessert, but I'm not going to have an appetizer just because I can't eat that much.
Well, you know what?
And I feel guilty.
What do women often do? And I was a waitress for a very long time. I feel terrible criticizing my fellow women. But you know what women often do when there's four or five of them out to dinner?
They ask for separate checks.
Yes.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate that.
Very, very common.
And as a non-drinker,
got their
I have
pen
to
out
say,
and they're adding up who had the salad and who had the dessert. And it's like, oh my God, what was the salad? Like $5? How can you even be arguing about this? So what about the hot food? Well, it's true.
As a non-drinker, I always make sure I get the most expensive dessert.
Yeah, you better get the most expensive dessert.
It's so a way of making up for it. Just tip heavy.
Exactly. Tip heavy. Well, that's what I mean. They're dividing it up to make sure no one gives you an extra 50 cents tip. That's a terrible thing to say about women.
Marjorie, but it was still my very alive, her waitress experience.
It was a great job. I love that fat wad of cash every night in my hand. It was wonderful. So there are these – what are the latest food trends, Corby, that we should be looking for during restaurant week? I know I was terribly behind on the – what did I say? What do you call it?
The farm-to-table.
Yeah, I know that was like 7 years ago or something. I'm a little
slow
on
this. Well, it's actually probably a few thousand years old.
A few thousand years old. Okay.
No, you're not that behind. The emphasis on farm-to-table, you know, it started taking hold a long time ago with Henrietta's. Gordon Hammersley himself started sourcing from farms. Anna Sorton, who married a farmer, Chris Kirth.
Really?
Lest we forget, Sienna Farms, where I spent all of Friday afternoon, and it's a wonderful farm stand. They have their own shop right next to the butcher shop in the South End.
Ooh.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Tell me the name again.
Sienna, named for their daughter, and the city in Italy, Sienna Farms. So that's been going a long time, but it's really only kind of taken root in the past 2 years. For example, a place I just reviewed in Boston Magazine, Giulia, G-I-U-L-I-A, near Porter Square in Cambridge. So that's straight-ahead, really authentic Italian regional food, but it's got the overlay of very careful farm sourcing, which would not have happened. At even a very good restaurant, Via Mata, which is on the Restaurant Week list.
Yes.
But, you know, it's part of the whole identity of Giulia now, that it's farm to table. So you're not that far behind.
Oh, good.
But
so
but
just don't feel bad.
You're also going into, like, Be Good, you know, some of the sandwich places, and I think it's Five Guys. And they have the pictures of the places where their potatoes came from.
Have you been to Sweet Green?
No.
Oh, you've got to go to Sweet Green. It is the first one. They have 17 locations in Washington. It's four kids right out of Georgetown have been terrifically successful. And they've opened it right in Copy Square on Boylston Street.
All right. Do you eat dessert when you go out for these restaurants, Corby? That's what
always.
I want to
know. Yeah, I love
he
dessert.
Does. Look at him. Look at him.
You're disgusting.
It's unbelievable.
Disgusting.
We should get a Stairmaster.
I'm starving now. Right now I'm starving. Well, Corby Cummer, thanks so much for joining us and getting our taste buds going. Corby is a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and a restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. If you'd like to learn more about Restaurant Week, please visit restaurantweekboston.com. So now that we've had our meals, are you ready for some drinks? Would you like to drink between 5 and 7 p.m.? Some places in the world, they call that a happy hour because you get good drinks cheap. Is it time to bring the happy hour back to Boston? We're talking about that next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Great column by Farrah Stockman in the Boston Globe tomorrow talking about a kind of an odd phenomenon in Boston, smoking small amounts of marijuana. That's okay now. Gambling is okay now. But finding a cheap drink in the late afternoon is absolutely verboten. Why is happy hour one of the last frontiers of fun that we can't enjoy anymore? It's been against the law for 30 years, not surprisingly, written into state law when Michael Dukakis was the governor. And we want to know if you think it's time to bring it back. The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. The most significant thing that Farrah Stockman points out in her story is that the idea that this was going to prevent drunk driving fatalities. Well, she points out that it is true fatalities have dropped in Massachusetts from 409 in 83 to just 130 in 2001. But the percentage of deaths related to alcohol dropped too. But it's not necessarily do with happy hour. It has to do with raising the drinking age, lower the legal limit, and, of course, credit to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. 30 years ago, if you were out drinking and you had a few too many cocktails, people would make jokes about that the next morning at the water
cooler.
How'd
you get home?
Exactly.
You didn't end up in the drink. Yeah.
If you have something too much to drink and you are out driving, which you obviously should never do, this is a source of shame in the workplace. No one is going to talk about this.
And someone will ask you to not drive or demand that you don't drive.
People have designated drivers all the time.
You know, Margie,
so I think it's time to bring this back. Think about restaurant week, and then you go over and have about four scotches. Not that you should have four scotches.
Well,
you
can do as many as you want as long as you're not driving.
As long as you're not driving.
That's fine. You can drink all day if you want. Listen, this is emblematic of the conflicted Puritan problem that not only Boston but America has with alcohol, with sex, with all sorts of things that the rest of the world is fine with. You know, the availability of alcohol that is, you know, not priced so high is not going to add to binge drinking. It's not going to add if we could just do, as we've been doing, better education, if we can make it, you're a hero if you stop someone from driving drunk. You know, the designated driver thing that we really work forward. And there are so many businesses, Marjorie, I was in again, I said Club Cafe last night. In the South End, got there a little early. If they had a happy hour, it would be very busy. You know, it was busy.
Well, that's it.
And it would be, people would stop in, have one drink, go home. You know, or maybe order an appetizer.
Well, they might have two drinks since you can get two for the price of one.
A lot of these happy hours,
that's the deal.
Sometimes it's just a lower quality of alcohol.
Yep.
Sometimes people don't partake in the deals. They stay with their high-end vodka. So it's just a marketing aspect. And, you know, I told you before we went on air, I used to be a DJ at the nightclub Molly's over in Alston back in the day.
You were? I did not know that.
And one of my...
A woman of many skills.
I was, yes. And one of the gigs I had, this is when we still had happy hour right on the brink there, was from 3 to 7 on Fridays, I did the happy hour. And all the BU students would be there and you'd walk in at 5 o'clock and it was like, midnight on a Saturday night. It was a blast. And then they would all go home, The club would clear out. They'd go to bed and come back in at midnight. They would, you know, and the club would start back up again. And think of the revenue that that generated for that establishment. They basically had, you know, as an inventory management viewpoint, they had two shifts of nightclub revenue that came in. You know, and it's the same with some of these lounges and restaurants. I just don't understand. The number is 877-301-8970. What do you feel about happy hour? 877-301-8970.
Well, here's another important factoid that Farah Stockman put in her piece in this morning's Globe. And she's in favor of bringing back the happy hour. And she talks about how other cities around the country have happy hours. What the heck's the matter with Boston? We can have a happy hour. She makes the point that in the city, it's much more justified because you're not out in the middle of the country where you have to drive 40 miles from the local bar to get back to your house. You can take the tea, you can take a taxi, you can have somebody drive you home. But last year, the Alcoholic Beverages Control Commission, they're the state organization, they held five hearings across the state about lifting the ban. Only 67 people showed up, and most of them were restaurant and bar owners who were basically worried about the competition that happy hours would bring, that people would come in and they'd get drinks for too cheap, and that some guy was worried that he spent a fortune on his upscale decor and happy hours might put him at a disadvantage, blah, 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 blah. Again, I think, I remember, you know, going out when you're young, when you're in your 20s, you don't have 2 cents to rub together. It was a great thing to go to a happy hour. The Park Plaza actually used to have one. Not the Park Plaza. What's the one in Park Square near the transportation building?
Whatever it is.
It's not there anymore, so it doesn't matter. But okay. They would have this happy hour where you could go in and get two drinks for the price of one, and they would have a buffet. So you could sit there and eat 9,000 pieces of cheddar cheese and little pieces of salami. Everything was terrible for your health and stuff, but you didn't care when you're 20 years old. You could basically get a free dinner with the happy hour. That was a big attraction to it, too. And as Corby Cummer just said when he was here talking about Restaurant Week, the booze is where a lot of these restaurants make the money, not in the food anyway. So it was kind of a win-win for everybody. The kids could eat for free, essentially, and the restaurant had a packed operation. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Should we bring back the happy hour to puritanical Boston or not?
I'm a fan of Mayor Menino. There's no doubt about it. But one of the things that we have significantly called him over at Bay Windows, besides our hero, is Mayor No Fun. You know, he's just no fun.
He is no fun.
He's no fun. He wants you home in bed, tucked in at midnight. We don't have the MBTA running. I understand the conflicts and the budget issues. But, you know, just think about an urban, wonderful hub of the universe where you can go have a happy hour, have an appetizer, jump on the tee, go home, take a disco nap, get back up, go to 10 o'clock dinner. What a crazy idea. Have dinner at 10 o'clock on Saturday night, then go to a nightclub, stay till 3 or 4 o'clock, get on the tee, go home and go to bed, get up and go to church like a nice Irish girl. How about that?
That's right. That's my routine every weekend.
Why can't we be that? Why can't we be that? 877-301-8970.
Should happy hours come back? Did you have one or two enjoyable happy hours when we still used to have them in Massachusetts, which is more than 30 years ago? Let's go to Dale in Shrewsbury. What do you think, Dale?
I think not. From hearing the conversation, it seems as though there's a lack of an awareness of the different cultural classes and groups of people we have in our state. And the fact is, you've just talked about you know, a lot of experiences with high-end restaurants and the fact that you're in the city and you can take the tea home when there's a world of Massachusetts out there that's blue-collar workers. And they speak in the terms of, let's go get trashed, let's go get loaded.
Well, Dale, I think those are good points, but, you know, no one is making it a mandatory thing that the bars have to do a happy hour. And in my small experience drinking, which lasted for quite a while, if folks are going to drink without care, they're going to drink till their pocket is empty. And it doesn't matter if there's going to be a special or, you know, they're going to drink a higher alcohol content at a low price to get the way they're going to get. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, a happy hour or just a regular price.
But the thing is, Dale, that the numbers of drunken driving fatalities have plunged in states that continue to have happy hours. And the statistics tell you it's not about happy hours. It's about raising the legal limit for drinking. They don't mention car safety, but that's a big thing, too, car safety.
And public
and
awareness.
And also that we've changed our attitudes about drunken driving. People don't think it's a joke anymore like they used to. But thank you for the call. Let's go to Yvette on the South Shore. What do you think? Should we bring back happy hours, Yvette, or not?
Hello, good afternoon. I feel that I don't think that the price of the drink makes that much difference, mm-hmm. and that some people would go because it is a happy hour. It just makes it a nicer thing for them to do, but some people go anyway. So to me, that really doesn't matter whether, to me, mm-hmm. but I think that for a lot of people, it would make a difference. And I have traveled all over the country, mm-hmm. and I noticed that where there is a happy hour, the bars are full, and people are having a snack to go with it, which gives business to the place. Anyway,
Yvette, you've got a clicking line, so I think we're going to have to let you go. But I absolutely agree with Yvette. I remember when I went to San Diego, they've got a great hotel there, and every Friday and Saturday night they have a happy hour. And you get there and it's packed, and people are just making plans to go out to dinner. Most of them, again, are buying full price drinks. You know, they're not taking advantage of the, what do they call it, the what's the, I see, it's been so long, Marjorie, I can't even remember.
The Bud Light special.
Well, yeah. The well two drinks, Heineken's, that's what they call it. The well drink, when you get the sort of generic vodka, and that's two for $2. Or you can have your Kettle One and spend $428.
So. Yeah, Kettle One is more pricey.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve from Taunton, should we bring back happy hours or not?
Absolutely not, and I love them. As a matter of fact, funny you mentioned it. Because I tended bar at Molly's in the late 70s.
Oh.
So, do you remember Sue?
Do you remember
she was there.
I can tell you a very funny wet T-shirt contest story once, but I'll save that for another time.
All I know is I came out of there at 3 o'clock in the morning. The plates were gone from my car.
Oh.
That's
the only memory of it. But
I anyway,
remember
we digress.
Maddie's down in Marblehead, Jacob's Ladder, Copperfields.
Yeah.
You're talking
remember
my
all
talk.
Those places?
Yes, I do.
It was all insanity, and I'm glad they're gone.
But it was a different time, though. You know, I mean, the drinking, to Marjorie's point, it was a very, I mean, no one ever said, don't drive. No one ever said, you know, you're too drunk to drive, or didn't find it to be a joke that you barely got home. I mean, it was a very different time. And now it's we're more safety conscious about how we're going to affect others.
You know, no one ever had a designated driver back in the 70s or probably even in the early 80s. You hear kids talking about, now maybe they're pulling your leg and maybe they're not telling the truth, but you hear children, teenagers, young people in their 20s that are old enough to drink. That's not
my teenager. My son's group always has a designated driver.
Exactly. That's my point.
No question.
And that's
but
my
you know
point.
What? It was Governor King that took me off the road. Once he started getting tough on drunk drivers,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden started to impose penalties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was Governor King, like, and I don't know when it was, early 80s, 81, whatever it was. But he's the one that took me right off the road. Once they started putting friends of mine away,
yeah,
I saw the light.
Yep, good job, Bob. Well, thanks for your input. That's a good point.
We should point out it was Michael Dukakis, actually, who changed the law in 1984. And his brother, I had forgotten this until I read it again this morning, his brother was mm-hmm. killed in a hit-and-run accident. No mention of any alcohol involved. But you think of Governor Dukakis as sort of a straight-laced guy, you know, the guy that still walks to Northeastern University picking up garbage.
I see him. I see him. It's always a very – I'm saying, who's that nice man picking up trash? Oh, it's Governor Dukakis.
You know, I followed him once because I was supposed to be asking him about something for the Boston Herald, and you see this guy who's got to be in his mid-70s now picking up trash with his bare hands.
And his Barracuda jacket, you know, his windbreaker.
And so I thought, well, I can't be walking behind him and not picking up the trash, so I'm picking up the trash, and I'm thinking, why don't we have like a little plastic bag to put all the trash in, you know, because you're picking up some pretty raunchy stuff there in his bare hands. He does it every single day. Let's take one more call before we go to Charlie Baker here. Bob from Medford, do you think we should have happy hours again or not?
Yes, I do think they should restore them. I think that what I remember when they were phased out, and what strikes me as interesting is if you travel like the country, there's still places that have happy hours. They're not the pure ones where there
yeah,
were, like,
a lot of places do.
Pizza clock, rage drinking, and things like that. You know, the social engineering that resulted from this was they had a lot of other resources that they could have put in place to take the drunk drivers off the road or give them a reason or an alternative after 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. And I often, you know, whether it's getting a voucher when you register your car or get your license mm-hmm. or keep the key open, as you mentioned. And the other thing is this, you know, the bars themselves, the legislature bailed them out. They were as much responsible for over-serving.
Mm-hmm.
And they never wanted to take the responsibility, and they basically let, you know, as you just mentioned a couple minutes ago, they let the legislature just clean the board and everybody was on equal footing and they didn't care less. And what it ultimately resulted in is that they made more money on their alcohol because they went back to standard pricing.
Yeah. No, yeah. He's absolutely right. I mean,
that's a great point. Thank you for that call, Bob. One other thing I should point out, too, when we're talking about what works, in Farrah Stockman's piece this morning in the op-ed page of the Globe, she talks about how Kansas just passed, just repealed its happy hour ban, but they passed a law requiring DUI offenders to install those in-car breathalyzers.
Right.
So you can't start the car unless you are sober. And the result, drunken driving fatalities declined from 138 in 2010 to 92 last year. So the bad behavior, that's what you want to punish.
You want to punish the bad behavior.
Everybody.
Right.
And most of us, happily, are not alcoholics. Right. We don't have drinking problems. At least I don't think I do. Only joking. But, you know, I mean, most people use alcohol responsibly.
Right.
And why penalize those of us who do and throw us in with those who
don't?
You
know, if we want to move to the next level of stopping drunk driving, all the state police and the police have to do is go to the parking lots where the nightclubs are getting out and where the restaurants are getting out and let someone pull out and pull them over. I mean, you know, we act as if this is some hard problem to solve in terms of, you know, catching people before they get on the road and then punishing them appropriately.
Yeah.
That's what the stick is. The rest of the population, which, as you say, drinks successfully without problem, without alcoholism, and without injury, shouldn't be punished. But another conversation.
Another conversation
will continue,
for another day.
Marjorie.
That's right.
But when we get back, more fun with Charlie Baker. It's open mic. Where does he come down on happy hour? We'll have to check with him. The state of the GOP, what's happening, healthcare. He's going to give us the 411 on all of that. So stay tuned for the conversation. It's 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Bank robberies are on the decline, but they're not gone.
When the tellers were free, we each approached our individual teller and handed over the note and stood there casually making conversation with them as they handed over the money.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Banks are getting smarter, so who is still robbing them? That story next time on Marketplace from APA.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where researchers are mapping people's travel patterns to forecast pandemics, giving global health policy a new direction. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Life of Muhammad, retrace the life of the Prophet Muhammad from his humble beginnings to the founding of the first Islamic constitution. Don't miss Life of Muhammad, Tuesday at 8 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows is filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. And joining us on the line, as he does every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, is Charlie Baker. Charlie Baker used to run Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. He was also the 2010 Republican gubernatorial candidate. Thanks, Charlie, for joining us. How are you?
Hey, guys. I was also, just FYI, a bartender.
Well, good.
At the Ale House in Harvard Square for about 4 years.
There you go.
While I was in and after I got out of college. So I was there,
well,
and I guess what they would call the good or the bad old days, depending upon your perspective.
Well, we were about to ask you your perspective, because many of the, you know, I just realized that all the folks that are talking about wanting a happy hour are well over, you know, this side of 45. So we've lived long enough to see it. What's your take on bringing back a happy hour for Massachusetts?
Well, what was really interesting to me about the conversation is it was a lot more varied than I thought it was going to be, and it got me thinking about some stuff I hadn't thought of before, so kudos to you and your audience. But I'm against it. I don't think we should bring it back, and I say that for three reasons. The first is happy hours were usually like from 5 to 7 on Thursday and Friday.
Yep.
And, you know, I attended bar a lot of times during that period, and people were in a hurry to maximize their return on their 5 to 7 happy hour, which always made me a little nervous. And the other thing that made me nervous was a lot of them didn't stick around after happy hour was over. You know, I don't know where they went, but I always wondered how many of them got in the car at what was basically sort of semi-dusk And in many cases, on Thursday and Friday, still rush hour, and hopped out into the crowd of people who are sort of still working their way home from work on a Friday or a Thursday. And second is the ability to really gauge when somebody's had enough. And I'm sure that's because I've been a bartender, and therefore, you know, I'm probably a little sympathetic to the profession. You're not necessarily the person who's the only person who's serving if you're working in a club with more than one bartender or more than one bar. And secondly, the time you can really tell somebody's drunk is sort of after they've had more than one too many. It's not so obvious that they're loaded when they buy, you know, the second mm-hmm. or third drink of the night, or the fourth or fifth drink of the night, but it might be the first one from you.
Yeah,
but John, and then the third issue is, you guys really miss it that much?
No, I don't even drink, Charlie. I don't drink, so it's not an issue of you know, am I going to have that much fun? But I also know there are plenty of people who drink before they go out, who come into a restaurant or a nightclub or a lounge with a flask, with nips.
They do?
Absolutely, because they don't want to pay. They don't want to pay the money. So from my perspective, if you're going to be a problem drinker, it doesn't matter what the price of the alcohol is. You're going to find a way around it to be that problem drinker. So, you know, and to Marjorie's point, why punish everybody else who are dramatically successful at not drinking over, I haven't really been out with Marjorie in a while, but,
yeah,
you know, not being
I haven't
in your
tied
cups.
One on this week.
So it just, you know, it just makes me feel like we're not a world-class city, that we can't, you know, we can't manage discounted booze. You know, it's like, oh, God, there they go.
Charlie, you're a Puritan in a minute, Charlie.
No offense, Sue, but I think there are a lot of other things that define a world-class city that go a little beyond whether or not people can buy a Cosmo for $1.50 on a Friday. Maybe I'm
perhaps.
Wrong.
Perhaps. Maybe.
Well, okay, Charlie, what's 13 days from now? Do you know?
Oh, is it Labor Day?
Very good.
It is Labor Day. It is Labor Day, and you said you're deciding whether or not to run for governor on Labor Day. Now, I want to know, do you mean Labor Day itself, like the Monday, or do you mean the weekend of Labor Day, or maybe next Tuesday, right before Labor Day, when you're on with us at Boston Public Radio?
Yeah, you're not going to make an announcement on Friday at 5.
I just really haven't thought about it that hard, Marjorie, but I'm really pleased to hear that you have.
Well, I'm not the only one who's pleased. We had Charlie Chipio yesterday on the radio with us. He's from Chipio Strategies. He's a political strategist. And he was asked, as we always ask everybody who comes on, a local political person, if they think Charlie Baker is going to run for governor. And here's what he said.
I sure hope he is.
Yeah.
I think that he would be the best governor, you know, of in my view, of the folks who are I'm seeing out there.
You see that? Charlie Chipio, you've convinced him already, and the race hasn't even begun, Charlie
and,
Baker.
And Scotto's out in Iowa.
That only cost me $20, you know? Amazing.
So you are going to be, though. That's the plan. That's the strategy. Charlie Baker will announce sometime during Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, very funny, Marjorie.
Okay. And Scott Brown, who, of course—
There must be things that are more important to you guys going on out there today than this.
It, well, it's a big
than
deal.
Than the future
it's,
of the it's, Commonwealth it's, of it's, Massachusetts?
It's a
Come
big
on.
Deal. It's a big deal for you, Charlie, because, you know, it is a big deal to be the governor of the Commonwealth, especially when for the Republican Party.
I totally
Party.
Agree with that.
Yeah.
Totally agree with that. Yeah.
And I have asked you before, or you have said to us before, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if Scott Brown were to run for governor, he's been out in Iowa now talking about testing the waters for a presidential run, which I think most people think he's probably not going to actually do, but that if he were to run for governor, then you would not run.
I don't think it makes sense. What I've said is I don't think it makes sense for both of us to run because the party's not that big and the resources aren't that deep, and on the Democratic side, you could easily have 3, 4, 5 people run, and there's plenty of support out there and plenty of activism to keep all of those candidates involved. There just isn't that much on the Republican side to make that work.
So that means you probably have a conversation with Scott Brown prior to your announcement, right?
Oh, yeah, I think that's a sure thing.
Okay. What do you think Scott Brown was doing out there in Iowa last weekend?
Well, I think first of all, Gail, I guess, is from Iowa, so
I did not know that.
We did not know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
So So on some level, it's, you know, probably a trip home for her, which is a good thing.
So does he get to use his campaign funds to fly there so he could visit?
I don't know. That's a really good question, Sue. Would you ask the same question of a Democrat if they did that?
Absolutely.
Just out of curiosity.
Absolutely.
Okay. The interesting thing to me about this is Marjorie and Jim, you know, you guys a lot of times talk about how much you wish the Republican Party would stand up and run what you would refer to as more moderate candidates for office. Scott's about as, you know, Scott is definitely a moderate Republican, certainly by national standards.
Yep, and I've come out in support of him running for president, to broaden the discussion.
From my point of view, you know, if you were to decide that's the direction you want to go, and he certainly has a national stature, he certainly has, I mean, he's an unbelievable retail politician. Mm-hmm. And if you think about Iowa and New Hampshire, which are the first two stops on the bus, they are tailor-made for a guy who campaigns the way he does. And I think the big issue would be, can he find a way to create that buzz for a moderate Republican that he would have to figure out how to create in a national party that I think is probably more conservative than he is. But boy, is he good in somebody's living room. And that's really where those races get won.
Charlie, what do you think happens at the RNC headquarters when a Scott Brown or Chris Christie, you know, someone who's more of the Massachusetts Northeast style of Republican, who, you know, many will say, and myself included, is sort of like the old-fashioned Republicans, the way things used to be. What happens in the RNC headquarters? Do they clutch their pearls a little bit and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe we have to deal with this? Or do you think they're optimistic that the Big Tent Party might become the Big Tent Party again?
I think it depends a lot on who you talk to and what their objective is. Think about when Rahm Emanuel was running the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC. His basic philosophy was: are you a Democrat, and can you win? And he didn't really, you know, he didn't draw a lot of big distinctions around ideological purity and that sort of thing. And when he was in charge of the DCCC, they had one of their best election cycles ever, and they won seats in all kinds of places that they normally didn't win, and he won them with, in many cases, what were certainly moderate and probably, according to a lot of people, conservative Democrats who won those races. And I think part of what Christie said the other day, which was, you know, does this really have to be a 100% litmus test on ideology, or do you want to win? And I think that's a reasonable question to ask people. You know, in theory, no one is ever supposed to get their own way in political life, given the way the system is set up. It was designed specifically to avoid the possibility of the consolidation of power in any one party or any one person or any one branch. And but as Christie said last week, if you don't win any elections, you probably don't have a heck of a lot of opportunity to do much of anything.
That's a good point.
And I think to some extent, both parties over the course of time have been guilty of too much focus on, you know, one or the other, winning or on principle, and that there's probably a middle ground there that makes the most sense. But I remember watching what Emanuel did when he was the head of the DCCC, and he basically said, look, I'm interested in winning races. And I'm sure a lot of the people, not a lot, but I'm sure several of the people that he ran for a bunch of congressional offices probably gave the Puritans and the Democratic Party a lot of heartburn, but a bunch of them won.
You know,
right?
Yeah,
our most recent senatorial candidate, Mr. Gomez, recently joined a Republican group that supports gay and lesbian rights, Out Proud, which is, I think it was founded by, or well, Mary Cheney was one of the founders, and it's got a broad base of Republicans who are trying to make a change in the GLBT issue within the party. Is, you know, I see that happen, and I think that's a great thing, and that really shows a badge of honor for Gabriel Gomez to reach out and do that. At the same time, you know, I wonder how does the rest of the Republican Party come along on that? You know, how do you move people the way that you've gone, the way that Scott Brown goes, the way that Gabriel Gomez has, in this sort of rational approach to a civil rights issue?
Well, you know, Sue, I mean, if you look at Okay, so let's take Massachusetts, right?
Yeah.
Gabe won the primary, right? If you take Scott's last two races, he won the primary. If you take my race, I won the primary, which is to say, didn't have an opponent and therefore was the party nominee. I would argue that to some extent the party, at least in Massachusetts, is a big tent party, because if you look we have a lot of different points of view and a lot of different positions represented. But generally speaking, most of the candidates who've been nominated by the party and the ones historically who've won have been sort of moderate type Republican that you're talking about.
Agreed.
I mean, they've been very, very conservative on certain issues, in some cases very liberal on others, but pretty hard to pigeonhole or classify as being all one way or another.
But how do you spread that to the national party? I mean, I'm going to assume that I'm going to say you're doing it the right way. So I'm going to assume you think the same thing. So how do you move it toward the greater Republican Party?
I think one of the great things Bill Clinton did when he was when he ran for president of the Democratic Party was he said we need to be about jobs and efficiency and accountability and effectiveness. And he moved the Democratic Party pretty significantly toward the middle, in my opinion, and created, I think, the recipe for success that they've had on a bunch of issues over the course of the past, when was he elected, 1992 maybe?
Yeah.
Over the course of the last 20 years. And I think to some extent, it's the candidate at the top of the ticket, especially in national races, who sort of decides and defines what the overarching perspective of any political party is. It's really hard for, you know, a congressman or a senator, even a Senate majority or minority leader or a Speaker of the House, to truly be the voice of a national party, because they have to manage their own constituencies, which typically have a lot more parochial interest than sort of national interest. So mm-hmm. I think to some extent what I would say to you, Sue, is whoever ends up being the Republican nominee for president in 2016, that's going to tell you a lot about the general direction of the party overall. And when you look at most of the candidates who are kicking around at this point, it's a pretty even mix of what you might call traditional conservatives and neocons and civil libertarians. And I mean, it's quite a little salad of points of view we got brewing there. And again, from my point of view, I think that's a good thing, and I think it says good things about the party. It's not like, you know, people are lockstep in one particular direction or the other.
Charlie Baker, and we are talking obviously to Charlie Baker. That's whose voice you hear. I'm Marjorie Egan, and she is Sue O'Connell. A new poll, one last question from me, shows that Congressman John Tierney, a Democrat from the North Shore, who narrowly beat Richard Tessay, this new poll shows there's a statistical dead heat now, and you know, many people were devastated, Republicans and independents, when Richard Tessay lost, because he was a very moderate Republican, just what we've been
many
talking about.
Many people were devastated. How about me?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
I live in the district. He's a good friend. Yeah. I was at his campaign headquarters.
Yeah. Well, this poll, and if people don't remember this, Tierney was linked to a scandal involving his wife's involvement in this illegal offshore gambling ring. Tierney said he knew nothing about it, didn't do anything wrong. But in any case, it was a very tight race. Lots of people wanted to have at least one Republican in the congressional delegation in Massachusetts. But based on this new poll, obviously just one poll, but still, would you advise Richard Tessay, or have you advised Richard Tessay to run again against John Tierney?
I think Richard, in the end of the day, will make his own call with respect to that.
Yeah.
But as his friend and his former running mate and admirer of Richard, it certainly helps. He takes a really hard look at it. And I think the poll indicates what we all knew last year. Or when was that? That was just last year.
Yeah, just last year.
That's a race that's winnable. And you add to the fact that there's going to be a pretty – I actually think Congressman Tierney is going to have a pretty tough primary. I know a lot of people – I live up in this area. I live in the town next door to Seth Moulton, who's the fellow who's planning to run against him. And he's no lightweight. So I think that could be – the primary on that side could be really interesting as well.
Charlie Baker.
I know it's really hard to be an incumbent, but – I think that could be a heck of a primary.
Yeah, I think
you're
so
right
too.
On that.
I think you are too. Hey, Charlie, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Charlie,
okay, guys.
Charlie Baker joins us every Tuesday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with our very special guest, columnist Alex Beam from the Boston Globe. Wow, he'll be filling in for Brian McGorry, so that'll be fun. When we come back, Callie Crossley and David Bernstein join us to help all the Boston residents narrow down the mayoral field. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Next time on The World, beards, beards, and more beards. The new Iranian president's cabinet is made up entirely of bearded men. What can facial hair tell us about someone's politics?
There is a social code, and you would recognize different people when you walk down the streets.
The code suggests some are religious and some are professional. The politics of facial hair, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And Welch & Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell is filling in for Jim Bridey. I am Marjorie Egan. And in case you missed last night's mayoral forum, where all 12 candidates gathered, including the sole Republican, David James Wyatt. I guess he's been sort of under the radar for most of this campaign. But in any case, he showed up last night. Callie Crossley and David Bernstein are here to bring you the Cliff Notes version. Callie, of course, is host of Under the Radar every Sunday night at 6:30. David Bernstein is our political contributor and a contributing editor at Boston Magazine. So, was there a person that just kind of wowed you last night, Callie Crossley?
Can I just cut in and say the person who wowed me was the moderator?
Really?
Callie Crossley.
Callie Crossley.
Thank you.
Okay, except for the star turn for Callie. Was there someone that just kind of knocked your socks off last night, you guys? Or was there a clear, impressive candidate? Or was it just...
Well, there was more than one. But I have to say, I really felt like a voter. I am overwhelmed by 12 mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I have to say. So if you don't come into this with somebody that, you know, you just feel right away you have a connection to, and you're trying to listen to figure out, you know, who's your person, you know, it can be overwhelming because I'm sitting there thinking, wow, oh, that was good. Oh, well, that's good too. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a good idea.
So yeah, that was just from my perspective, sitting there as a moderator and not having as much long distance as I might if I were sitting in the forum, and that's where David comes in.
Well, and I totally agree. And what came across, I thought at that forum as well as elsewhere, but really in that forum, was that it's not just that you have 12 candidates, but you have a lot of very legitimate candidates.
Mm-hmm,
you know that
mm-hmm.
that it's not. Yeah, it's not like you've got, oh, the three.
The rent
who...
is too high.
Right.
The rent is too damn high.
Right.
No, that was legitimate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we could use people saying that actually in Boston. But, very knowledgeable people who can have a knowledgeable discussion about it. You know, not just, you know, there's some forums where they each get to talk about 2 minutes about public safety, mm-hmm. about development, about this and that. But it's something like this where it really got in depth about neighborhood development and economic development because that was the focus of it, and they could all talk really in depth about it, about you know how the BRA works and how they prefer it works, how permitting and you know all these different things, it's not like a bunch of crazy people or a bunch of you know people on you know who know their stuff but are just ideologically way out of step. It's a lot of candidates.
All 12?
Well, I wouldn't say all 12.
Can you help people eliminate at least a couple here that maybe – I mean, David James Wyatt that I've talked about, we've not really seen him anywhere. He showed up last night. I don't think most people consider him to be in the top tier.
No, he's not in the top tier. Yeah. But I got to say, and David can disagree with me, for the few questions in which he really answered, because mm-hmm. there's a couple where he said, oh, I don't know. You have to ask the other people on the panel. Mm-hmm. He had some stories from the perspective of a business owner mm-hmm. and what he thought should be legitimate complaints. One, why do you have to pay many, many times to go through this really complicated permitting system.
Yeah.
This stops people from being able to have a business. And why is it that it is so complicated to go from here to there to whatever? And he told a very legitimate story about a feeling that the community was not being heard in these instances, and development was sort of running over them, and whatever they thought in the community was not being that's legitimate.
This is on the liquor license point, where like Dudley Square, for example, has like zero. Do they still have zero? Do they have one liquor license by now? I think they still have none, which is disgraceful.
What was the quote last night from, I think Felix Arroyo was nine, mm-hmm. and all of, or maybe that was John Barrows, and all of Mattapan.
Yeah, there's more about Mattapan.
That's pretty bad.
Some startling mm-hmm. numbers. No, and you know, we've talked about the liquor license issue, which the city council's really raised again, you know, into the forefront. No, I think that, you know, David James Wyatt, you know, he's clearly
but
in this.
But let's not talk about David James Wyatt.
Okay, yeah.
Because he's not going to be the mayor of Boston. Let's give people some guidance here.
Says
well,
Marjorie
he's not.
Egan.
I don't think he's going to win. Give people some guidance here. Were there people that stood out?
Well,
we've got 12 people. We need to narrow this group down.
Well, it really is difficult. You know, mm-hmm. John Barrows, like Callie said.
He's a great candidate.
Is a great candidate. You know, I can't tell you how many people have said to me, geez, if this guy was running for city council at large, he'd have one of those four seats. He just really wows mm-hmm. people.
Yep.
People just aren't really sure he can, you know, sort of expand his reach enough to, you know, in the city. But he's very impressive, which I've always thought mm-hmm. so. You know, and he's showing it in this
race.
Tell
people about him. Who's John Barrows?
He heads up the Dudley Square Neighborhood Initiative. And he's been doing that for a number of years. Young guy.
Was on the school committee.
Yep. Was on the school committee
very
for a while.
Very thoughtful. Mm-hmm.
Very thoughtful. Very interesting. Very engaging. He's got a really cute baby. Yeah. A really cute kid. Yeah.
He's a good-looking guy.
Yeah. A good-looking guy. you know, a lot of sort of youthful vigor. Yep. He makes you think of sort of a, you know, like a, I don't want to, you know, lump him with, you know, but like a Cory Booker. Sort of that like,
energy,
young, new Boston kind
smart,
of, you know,
but right. smart.
And smart and really, and he's new Boston in that sense, but he's also really familiar with City Hall and really familiar with the players and the processes. He knows what's possible and what isn't, you know.
I think, if I may add, that's where he excels in that he's able to take policy and bring it right down.
That's right.
Here's how the policy does not work in real people's lives, and here's how it works. I think that's attractive to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So
it was a good forum for him, too, because what he's always been about is that sort of neighborhood development. How do we make this neighborhood, Dudley Square, in his case?
Okay, John Barrows sums up. You got John Barrows. Who else? John Conley's the front runner in terms of the numbers right now.
I thought he was good. Well, you know, he left before the closing statements last night, and I'm not quite sure why. I guess he just had to go.
Yeah.
And, of course, we didn't know. Maybe David knew that he was about to get $500,000 from Stand for Children, mm-hmm. which would have been interesting.
Yeah.
A point. But I thought he came across quite well.
Yeah.
As you know, he was the first to get in
to the race. Big on schools.
Before he knew that Menino was going to step down.
Mm-hmm.
So he said some time to think about a number of things, and I thought he articulated mm-hmm. well. I just want to say, in general, when you ask, you know, one of the questions that I came away impressed with a lot of people, we asked about how do the small businesses get financing?
Mm-hmm.
People had creative, interesting ways to do it that you could see can happen. Not some, well, what we really should be is standing and talking to the banks and holding their hands and singing with them and maybe some, you know, it was really creative, thoughtful answers. And mm-hmm. you know, I have to say Bill Wozniak came across with a good answer to that. Of course, Felix Arroyo has been touting that for some time. Yeah, John Conley, you just mentioned him. I thought about the fact that he wants to do venture capital. He was very specific about Next Street Venture Capital Firm mm-hmm. being a company that could be tapped for this. I mean, people had good, thoughtful suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were prepared and ready to go. So, what's so important about economic development? You know, what is it about this topic that's important to the Boston voters? You know, how did you make the connection for the voters and the candidates?
This was sponsored by the Main Streets organization. If people don't know, these are local organizations that really boost neighborhood development and small businesses. First started by Thomas Menino mm-hmm. way back when. He brought it to Boston and Roslindale, quite successful. This is a successful organization across the country. So their entire focus was, when we say development in Boston, and I tried to make this point, you know, most people think big business and downtown. What does that look like in the neighborhoods, and what kind of impact does having a very strong neighborhood development and a boost to small businesses in those communities mean? And so that's was the focus, and that's what we're trying to
do. And I would say one name we left out, Charlotte Galore Ritchie, who gets to take a considerable amount of credit of being part of the creation of those Main Street programs.
Right.
She was in the administration at the time. And I thought that she came across very self-confident on these sets of issues, you know, in ways that
maybe... And did she have specific ideas? You know, because some of the rap against her is that she hasn't had a lot of
specific.
Thank you. issues, you know, ideas that have come forward at this point in the campaign. Not that she doesn't have them, but she's expressing them. Yeah.
And it's an interesting point because a lot of her pitch, in a way, is I'm going to continue what the administration has been doing and keep doing more of it. You know, and so there's sort of a question of, do the voters want that sort of continuation with sort of new ideas, new energy, but essentially a continuation, or someone who's really going to come in and, you know, reach out for the kinds of ideas that I think sitting and watching that forum, one of the things that, you know, has to come into your head is, geez, how come the Minio administration has not been open to these kinds of ideas? We going to have a mayor who will?
You know what's going to happen here after Menino's gone? All the criticisms are going to of Menino and what's been wrong for the last 20 years, we're going to hear about them. So everybody's too afraid to criticize him now because he still wields so much power, although it's less and less every single day. We're talking with Callie Crossley and David Bernstein, who were at this mayoral forum last night. You guys haven't mentioned the two guys. Well, John Conley's I think he's one of the top money raisers. He's the guy that announced before Menino announced that Menino was not going to run, and he's the big school reformer. That's John Conley. Marty Walsh is the longtime state representative, big union guy, a lot of union support. He's got a story about that he mentioned in the paper about quitting drinking. So I suppose maybe the people that also quit drinking might be attracted to his candidacy. Who knows? And Dan Connolly, the other guy, this district attorney of Suffolk County, has raised a lot of money. So where were Walsh and Connolly last night in your estimation, Kelly Crossley?
Let me just add to the Charlotte Galore Ritchie and say that the question of microfinancing came up, and she had a totally different take on it. She said there's some non-bank resources that ought to be tapped. This is what I mean about people really coming to the table with some different stuff.
Right.
So just to say that she's very specific about that. And
specific.
And I can get it out.
No one can say it.
And it was a little bit different from everybody else's stuff. So that's how she was distinguishing herself. Okay, so now back to Marty Walsh. He was impressive as well.
Okay.
I thought he, well, particularly around the financing issues and the permitting and licensing. I mean, he's like, you know, this makes no sense. You know? This makes no sense.
Yeah.
That people can have to, you know, wander all around to get a license to operate and to return something to the city. So I thought he was clear. And what did you think, David?
No, I thought he was pretty effective.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't come across as sort of, the in-depth knowledge of the issues, you know, the sort of, you know, drilling down bits, but that's not necessarily, you know, what you need the mayor to be saying on every single topic. He was impressive. I thought Dan Connolly, who's not really known for that kind of stuff, he's more, you know, the law and order DA, but he did sort of go back a lot, talk about, I was city councilor for Hyde Park, where I was, you know, very involved in these kinds of neighborhood development issues. All of them sort of clearly were able to talk about it and with some comfort level. And it's interesting, you said a minute ago, like, you know, what is the importance of these, you know, neighborhood economic development?
Right.
I've been doing these interviews with the city council candidates.
Soon
I talk about this. I'm getting there. I'm over 30, so I'm getting close. I've been struck. We talked about this the other day on the radio. At how many of them talk about these kinds of neighborhood development, economic development. You know, whether it's Hyde Park and what the new Fairmont Indigo line will do for that, or, you know, how to get, more restaurants open in almost sort of micro neighborhood development, because that's, you know, these city council candidates are the ones really out there talking, you know, door to door with people on the ground, you know. And so that's clearly what they're hearing. It's not all about the schools and public safety. They really are hearing, like, we want our neighborhood to be better developed, mm-hmm. so that there's more jobs, but also so that it creates a better neighborhood. And
well, yeah, the foot traffic alone. You know, I've said this a billion times. When I've lived in Mission Hill back in the 90s, we didn't have any restaurants. You know, we had a couple of places. There was no foot traffic. There was no.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
You know, we had a great community garden. You know, but it just it you need to have.
All of these things come together, and the mayor could let me just add this one thing, if I may, Marjorie, and that's to say that I thought that people took care last night to speak out of their strength on the same issues. Now, what do I mean by that? Because you ask about Dan Connolly, right. not John Connolly. And Dan Connolly made it clear, I am a manager. And what you need in office is a manager. And so as he answered the questions, and some of his solutions may be similar to others, but he did it through the lens of being a manager. Okay. So each person tried to do that.
We have about 30 seconds left here. Can you guys eliminate anybody for the Boston voters who are listening right now? They've got 12 people. I mean, is there someone that's out of their element, or was everybody just wonderful last night?
I can't eliminate it. I'm going to let David have the last words. I can't eliminate people, but I will say this.
What?
When these forums take place and they were asked to fill out detailed questionnaires, 10 of the candidates did so. Charles Yancey and Charles Clemens did not. I do not appreciate that as a voter or as a person who's trying to bring
a
the
little,
information.
A little X on Clemens and Yancey, then City Councilor Yancey. Go ahead, David. Anybody out of their league?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily out of their league, but I think that Yancey maybe is not quite attuned to the city's, you know, the city's electorate at the moment, you know, and maybe Clemens also, as impressive as he sometimes is.
All right. We look forward to more of this discussion. Kelly Crossley, of course, is host of Under the Radar, which you can catch right here on Sunday night at 6:30. David Bernstein is our political contributor and a contributing editor at Boston Magazine. So all of you LGBT-friendly sports fanatics and vodka drinkers, should the U.S. boycott the Winter Olympics in Russia? How their anti-gay laws are intersecting with the sports world is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Treme Cookbook is inspired by the HBO series and by real voices on the streets of New Orleans.
Boy, you gotta soak your red beans before you do them the night before. Otherwise, they're gonna take forever to cook. Oh, you need to put pickle meat in them beans. I don't know what all this vegetarian stuff is about. You need you some pickle meat.
The flavor of a show and of a city, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau. Restaurant Week Boston is back. You can enjoy dining at over 190 restaurants throughout Greater Boston. Restaurants, menus, and reservations at bostonusa.com. And Patricia Baker, Realtor at Keller Williams Realty, helping home buyers find property in this challenging seller's market. More information available online at patriciasellshomes.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 is Shira Springer, the sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. Shira joins us every month to talk about the intersection of sports and society. And if there ever was an intersection, how about the Winter Olympics and Russia's anti-gay laws? Shira, welcome back. You know, tell people what is going on in Russia that's got everybody contemplating a boycott of these Olympics. Not everybody.
No,
but,
well, a lot of
but
people.
But lots of people contemplating
doing
a boycott.
Something.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Some sort of stand.
What are the Russians up to?
Well, it's mostly Vladimir Putin and what he's up to. In June, he passed a law that, quote, bans the propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, which essentially means it's an anti-gay law. And it's incredibly broad and incredibly vague. And many people say that a lot is lost and or gained in translation, though some punishment has been for any sort of demonstration that promotes homosexuality has been detention in jail for up to 2 weeks. You can be deported if you're a foreigner. It's uncertain what action they might take against Olympic spectators, fans, or athletes who somehow either demonstrate or show solidarity with the gay community. All of this is sort of up in the air and very, very vague. The International Olympic Committee has asked Russia for clarification. 6 months to go before the Sochi Olympics. They're still waiting for clarification.
Now, this also feeds into how folks behave on the street. You know, it's not only just these vague laws that are or are not enforced. There's also been a number of horrific beatings and murders of perceived gay people, of trying to have some sort of gay pride celebration over the past few years, or you know, not even a celebration, more of a protest, and just being brutally killed and harmed. So, you know, you've got the intersection of, that's our word for the day, intersection of what the government says and how that trickles down onto the streets. So, you know, what you have is a number of openly gay Olympians from around the world. You have Olympians who have openly gay parents. You have sports commentators who are openly gay, and they are fearful of going to Russia for fear of either having an incident with a Russian or being arrested or detained. And, you know, to put this in perspective, too, you know, we went to China and they have all kinds of human rights violations. But somehow, because it didn't affect the actual attendees of the Olympics, it really has hit home in a way that it hasn't before.
And it's interesting that you bring up China, because I think in a bad way, the Russians sort of learned something from
right.
China, which was basically prior to the 2008 Beijing Olympics, China sort of told the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, everything they wanted to hear about human rights. They were going to be more tolerant, more open, that they would ease some of their stances with regard to human rights. And that didn't happen. And the IOC sort of doesn't like to get its hands dirty and stood back mm-hmm. and said, oh, we're not going to mess with this. And I fear, and my great fear, even as a reporter going there, is that the IOC, they're waiting for clarification. They don't want to get their hands dirty. And they have this whole stance that the Olympics should not be political. Well, I have news for them. The Olympics are political. From the very moment you choose a city,
right.
the Olympics are political. From the moment you chose Beijing, from the moment you chose Rio, from the moment you chose Sochi, you were wading into political
waters. So, Marjorie,
waters.
You haven't seen this, but there's these two relay racers, runners, who are from Russia, very attractive blonde Russian women.
They
have been kissing on when they win. And this action, which is either two comrades kissing because they won a race, or a political action, which some people are beginning to think they don't have a big history of kissing on the lips like this.
Yeah.
This would be illegal. You know, this simple action would be illegal.
And to follow up on that, yesterday those two women issued a statement saying we're both happily married to men.
Right.
To clarify, you know, this was to trying to place themselves in the camp of, oh, this was just a joyful celebration of mm-hmm. a victory. However, the fact that people are talking about it in the context of the anti-gay laws is, I think, obviously what's important here. And I think Russia very much wants to control the dialogue and the image projected from the mm-hmm. Olympics. And even, you know, what could be innocent celebrations like that or not, that is going to be the conversation now in Sochi. Because I tell you, every reporter like myself is going to be looking out for either examples of some subtle protest by an Olympian or something larger.
I have to say, though, the kissing as a choice is good for a protest. I'd rather be kissing than doing anything else.
Just let me give out the number if people want to weigh on what we should be doing here, because we're getting some emails. I don't give the email address out enough. I apologize. The email address is bpr@wgbh.org. I think that is correct. bpr@wgbh.org.
I'm not sure.
Our phone number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think we should do about these pending Olympics? Should there be a boycott? Should the United States boycott? We just had an email from Scott who said he didn't think a boycott would be a good idea for all the hard work that the American athletes and athletes from around the world have put into this. But he's talking about some sort of a more subtle protest. I'm sorry, Scott, I can't read it exactly, but I think it was something like a rainbow flag mm-hmm. or some sort of solidarity with gay athletes. Sure, if Springer from the Boston Globe, you've been covering this for a long time. What do you think should happen?
It's interesting. First of all, boycott, I think, should absolutely be off the table. I think, in fact, the best thing in many ways you can do is show up and write about what's happening and draw attention. Nothing draws attention to a particular area, city, state, country, than the Olympics. They're on the world stage for, you know, a good 2+ weeks. So I think in some ways going there brings more exposure to the issue. I will be interested to see what people do. I think there were two Swedish women who recently at the World Track and Field Championships, the same athletic event where the two Russian women kissed in celebration, they painted their nails in rainbow tones. Oh, I think we're going to see a lot of that. I really hope that Johnny Weir, one of America's top figure skaters, makes the 2014 Olympic squad.
Married to a Russian-American man.
Yes, I was going to say very openly gay, very proud and out and willing to speak about this issue head on. And I could see him having a very interesting costume. You know, some sort of he's known for his sort of flamboyant and provocative and dramatic costumes. And you know, some sort of rainbow costume. And I think we're going to see a lot of the rainbow pins, though the IOC has protested and said, you know, listen, anyone who's wearing these rainbow pins, beware, that could be construed as propaganda and violate the Olympic charter.
I mean, you know, the other thing that's been happening here in America is a number of gay bars started doing vodka pours, you know, taking what they perceived as Russian Stoli vodka and pouring it out. But it turns out, of course, Stoli's
it's from Latvia.
It's not from Russia.
Who knew?
Who knew? You know, but
is there any vodka from Russia that we should be protesting?
I don't know what it – I mean, I think that the whole misguided idea of, you know, harming the Russian business people is – but people like George Takei, who's, you know, known as Sulu from Star Trek, who's a gay rights advocate, an openly gay man, has suggested at one point, you know, really going there as you have, and others have suggested moving it to Canada. You know, it's no one really wants a boycott, and for the reasons we've stated, that the athletes have worked so hard, but at the same time, they're it's an interesting point. David Bernstein just made as he was leaving the studio 10 years ago. He thinks this month was the famous kiss between Madonna and Britney Spears on like the MTV Awards or something. And that was a major, oh my gosh, moment where what are we going to tell our kids? Madonna's kissing Britney Spears. And now here we are 10 years later where an entire country is concerned, entire world actually, it's not just America concerned about this. How do we go to Russia with their LGBT hatefulness?
301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. What should be done about the Russian Olympics and their vows via the president, Putin, to be cracking down on people who show any sort of vague type of affection or any, you know, any thing that would indicate that they are gay or sympathetic to the gay cause? David from Brighton, what do you think about this, David? Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I think that we shouldn't boycott the Olympics. I think we should show solidarity with the gay and lesbian community. And I think we need to pull a Jesse Owens and actually show them that, you know, the gay and lesbian community of America is just as good as anyone else in the world, and sometimes even better. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need to very much show that our nation is made up of different people and cultures and ideologies. And, you know, we need to move forward and be an example for the rest of the world to show them that, yes, we can have many different people and go the distance with anyone else in the world.
Well, David, it would be kind of fun, wouldn't it, if all the gay athletes beat all the straight Russian athletes? And then you could sort of
well,
do
you know,
it.
That's
so
Putin.
There, to Putin. Thank you for the call,
you
David.
You know, Putin is very gay. I have to say this. He's got his shirt off.
That's
riding
horseback.
You know, riding his horseback gay. Yeah. You know, some rescuing people and standing very...
Flying with the geese. Remember that episode?
Remember the geese. And then he had his boyfriend who became president or whatever they are over
Medvedev,
there.
Medvedev, right?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, well, that's...
You know, they've got a very homoerotic relationship. And as, you know, as we all know, when you are very anti something, it's usually because you have those feelings yourself.
Well, I do wonder what is up with Putin that in 2013 he decides to make this statement and pass this law right before the Olympics.
It's politically motivated. You know, but I think it's part of.
And
his,
he's getting divorced. That's right. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me of that, Chelsea. So who knows where he's going to expand his horizons?
But he wants to differentiate himself from the West. I think this is sort of a look at America being very pro-gay rights, doing a lot of forward thinking. This is how he differentiates himself in one way from the West. But I think, you know, with the caller, I think this is a tremendous opportunity to really do something special and have a forum to talk about tolerance, to talk about gay rights, to talk about human rights. I mean, one of the things I thought that journalists could do, because you don't want to make a story or be part of the story, but something, you know, we're all going to be tweeting over there. Something as simple as a tweet that is a civil rights or a human rights oriented tweet every morning, and you just hashtag Sochi Olympics.
Right.
You know, something very, very simple that sends a message of tolerance out there to start the day.
And you've got, you know, I can't remember which athlete it is, but one of the athletes has two moms, you know, and a very prominent athlete, or I can't, you're looking at me like I should know this. I don't know. I'm just talking. I'm just making stuff up. But I mean, this is, you know, how you want to be there for your kid, you know, and your kid shouldn't be concerned about your safety or, you know, that you're going to get arrested in Russia. And as much as this sounds to some, well, that would never happen. That would never happen at the Olympics. You know, this is Russia's moment on the stage, and you never really do know what's going to happen.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you have any creative ideas about how people can make a subtle protest, or maybe you don't think there should be a protest at all, and maybe you think this is much ado about nothing. Dan from Worcester, what do you think? Should there be a boycott at the Olympics, a protest? What do you think?
Hello, Margie.
Hey, Dan.
Hello, everyone. I just, you know, I was just saying to the screener, I haven't got a problem with the gay community at all. The only thing that bothers me about it at all is we're going to go to a country, we're going to someone else's country. Let's just tone it down a little bit for the time that we're there. As far as the flamboyance and all that stuff, just back off on it a little bit, and let's have a little time to have some fun. Let's send these people over there to enjoy the Olympics, enjoy the camaraderie, the family togetherness, the whole bit that goes with it, and kind of tone down the stuff. Why does everything have to be a controversy? Why does every issue have to turn into somebody's protest? That's the only thing that I have to say.
Okay, Daniel, thank you for the call. I think Sue O'Connell may disagree with you, but go ahead, Sue.
I think every Olympics has had a controversy over one thing or another. And I totally agree with his point that when you're in someone else's home, you know, you go by their rules. I absolutely support that and agree with that. But I think what we have here is a generation. Remember, 99% of the Olympic athletes are going to be heterosexual. 99% of their parents are going to be heterosexual. And this is a generation that looks at this intolerance and brutality as a civil rights and human rights issue that's happening in Russia. So they're not so necessarily just protesting that it's gay. They're protesting that it is a brutality against people and from their political perspective. So and I think, you know, and again, I think the fact that no one's really calling for a boycott, but just wants awareness made about it.
Yeah, and I would refer back to, again, the World Track and Field Championships that took place this past week in Moscow, which was sort of a test case in some ways for Sochi, what's going to happen. And the protests, when I put that in quotes, were not in-your-face protests. They were very, very subtle. Again, the rainbow nail polish. There was an American 800-meter runner, Nick Simmons, who basically got on Russian TV, and he won a silver medal in the 800, and he said, I want to dedicate my medal to all my gay and lesbian friends back home. I don't think that's in-your-face protest. Mm-hmm. I think that's tasteful and yet allowing the athlete to represent or present his individual
views. Yeah, and we're representing America. I mean, this is what America is. You know, we don't want to tone down. If you think toning down gay support of GLBT civil rights is toning down flamboyance, I would argue that's what America is. You're asking us to tone down being American.
That is the voice of Sue O'Connell with us in Studio 3 as well as Shira
Tweet
Spears.
That one out, babies, huh? There you go.
Sports and Enterprise investigative reporter for the Boston Globe who covers intersection of sports and society. We're taking some calls on what you think we should do about these Olympics in Russia. Kelly from Tewksbury, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Marjorie.
Sure.
It's so nice to hear you. I just don't think that we can show up there and just fast forward Russia to the point of acceptance that we are here in the States. And one of you mentioned when you're a guest at someone's house, you should abide by their rules. I just don't think sexual orientation should have anything to do with the Olympics. They're there to do they're athletes that are very skilled at what they do. Why should sex have anything to do with it?
Well, Kelly, what would happen if we went to a country and they thought that interracial marriage was illegal, and if you were involved in an interracial relationship, you would be arrested? How would you feel about that?
Well, I think that's scary, and I think that's sad. I'm just really torn, because why should these people miss out on what they've worked for the last four years, however, how can they be so backward?
Yeah, I guess, Kelly, the issue is, if you are in a gay relationship and you win the 100 meter and your partner happens to come down when you're in the winner's circle and gives you a hug, I think there's some concern. Correct me if I'm wrong, Shira.
You're absolutely right. That's the concern.
That you'll get arrested. But anyway, this is a discussion to be continued. When are the Olympics, please?
They start February 7th.
Okay. Start February 7th. We got a ways to go yet. Shira Springer joins us every month to talk about the intersection of sports and society. Thanks for being with us, Shira.
Thank you.
And thanks to you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with columnist Alex Beam from the Boston Globe and by pilot Patrick Smith, taking your calls on all things air travel. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. She is Sue O'Connell. Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow. We'll